Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It's been 9 years since Tropical Storm Irene blew through Vermont and wreaked such devastation. One thing I remember for years afterwards was that I kept hearing about this Vermont Community Loan Fund helping businesses recover. I kept wondering, who are these cats? I thought maybe it was just set up after Irene to help the state recover. Well, they were helping, but it turned out they've been doing this kind of thing for a while. We're going to spend this hour learning about VCLF and the work they've been doing since 1986. Joining me is Executive Director Will Belanger. I want to thank you for being on the program today, Will.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Rick. I appreciate having me on.
Absolutely. And Jake Ide is the Director of Investment and Philanthropy. Jake, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be with you.
Listeners, if you have questions about the work of the Vermont Community Loan Fund, or if you've been the beneficiary of one of their programs, give us a call, 244-1777. Our numbers are also 877-291-8255. That's the toll-free number, 877-291-TALK. And you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Will Belanger, what is the overall mission of VCLF?
Well, thanks, Rick. Thanks for asking. So the Vermont Community Loan Fund, really our mission is to create opportunities that can lead to healthy communities and financial stability for all Vermonters. And we really are, you know, we're really focused on capital-based approaches to combat issues of poverty and opportunity. And, you know, as you said, we've been around since 1986 and have been doing this work here in Vermont all this time. And, you know, I just want to, as an aside, I was, you know, right before you brought me on, we can hear the ads or the break time that's going on. And I love hearing about the Hunger Mountain Co-op, one of our borrowers, you know, one of their ads on there and the work they're doing with their neighbors, to neighbors, work. And you know, it's things like that that make me proud. And when you listen to folks that we've helped and drive around Vermont and see folks that we've helped, it's pretty special.
Boy, Hunger Mountain Co-op. I can't imagine living in central Vermont and not having them, such a vital part of the community. So you mentioned the mission. How is it realized in actual practice?
Yeah. You know, we're what's called named this by the federal government when they started recognizing organizations like ours as a community development financial institution, which is, you know, nice government words for labeling institutions and groups. But at our core, we're a revolving loan fund. We're a mission based kind of mission impact revolving loan fund. And we seek to use to try to overcome obstacles that people have in creating wealth and in creating financial stability for their households. And we do that by providing access to capital, by access to loans for folks that have difficult or have traditionally struggled to be able to access loans and capital in order to run a business, get housing, affordable housing, whether it's to access childcare. And so we look at financing just those things. Mm-hmm. We lend our money to affordable housing developers. We lend our money to small businesses. We lend our money to early care and learning enterprises and to other nonprofits that are providing services. And we really, our goal really is to, you know, how can we increase people's wealth so that they can improve their lives. And we typically are financing those projects and those businesses and those organizations that have struggled in the past in getting the capital they need for their work from traditional sources. And then the other side of the business really is where we get our money. We have a tremendous amount of support from Vermonters who lend us money. Vermonters who lend us money for a for these purposes. And these Vermonters care about Vermont. They care about the people and the communities of Vermont. And so they're interested in both having their, you know, doesn't need to be a lot of wealth, but a little bit of wealth that they might have, lending it to us and allowing us to turn around and lend it for the purposes I talked about. And well, that's really at our core what we do.
And you kind of teed it up for Jake Ide. Jake, what is your role in ensuring that there is that necessary money to be able to loan this these funds to organizations?
Yeah, sure. Well, I am, if our lending team are on the side to put the money out the door, my team brings the money in. And so we're working with folks who want to invest in Vermont, invest in the loan fund. And we mechanically, it works a lot like a CD product at a bank, where the investor gets to choose how long they want to lend us the money. They obviously get to choose the amount. And then we'll pay them fixed interest over the time that we have their money. And while we've got it, we'll lend it out to create the kind of change that they expect us to make in the community.
Well, what kinds of organizations do you make loans to?
You know, it's a pretty wide array. You know, when we look at Hunger Mountain Co-op is a good example of someone who really fits into our focus on food farms and forest, on the access and delivery of food and the sustainability of our land. They're a great example of a organization that fits into that critical system here in Vermont for our incredible farm to plate system that we've created and are working on here in Vermont. But you know, I'll highlight a couple that I think are pretty interesting that we just are new borrowers. One is a good example is out in Shelburne is Fisher Brothers Farm and the Sisters of Anarchy Ice Cream.
Oh yeah,
so this is a family that's out there, and you know, I have to bring up something that's delicious
please
to eat when we're talking food farms and forests. You know, they've come in. I think in like 2013, they started up in Shelburne with the farm. They've got three daughters. Those are the Sisters of Anarchy, the original Sisters of Anarchy, I guess, who really help with them. The first year in 2014, I think they made something like 250 gallons of ice cream, right? Mm-hmm. In 2020, they made 12,000 gallons of ice cream. And they came to us. You know, we're in the middle, as we all know, in the middle of a health crisis and an economic crisis. They came to us really in a panic during the early stages of the pandemic, when a lot of the events that they were selling their ice cream through were canceled. And we were able to help them get a PPP loan that the thing we've all heard about for months, that those Paycheck Protection Program loans through this Small Business Administration. Well, we were able to help them facilitate them getting one, and that was something they really needed to get them through this current period. I think that's a good example both of the kind of ability of us to access or to help someone access capital, as well as the kind of business that we're looking. It's a small farm we're looking to support. It's a business venture that's growing and has, you know, has some pretty good growth potential for Vermont.
Well, I'll stop you there for a moment. Yeah. What kind of criteria do you use then to approve a loan to an organization, a borrower like that?
You know, I mean, I would say we are looking for both an impact, a community or a social impact when we're financing. That's probably the first screen. Is this business providing good quality job? Is it in a rural community and really providing a critical kind of economic activity within rural communities in Vermont? Is it providing perpetually affordable housing? You know, are they developing critical housing needs or providing critical services to a low-income or low-wealth or diverse community in Vermont. We look at that first. And then we look at, then like a bank, we look at, can they repay the loan, right? We have those, as Jake had mentioned, those folks that have lent us and invested in the Vermont Community Loan Fund. We have to repay them. And so we look at, like a bank, all of those credit decisions, do we think that they can repay that loan? And we balance those two, and it is a balance. We can take more risk than a bank because our sources of capital are allow us to take more risk. They want us to take more risk. That's why they're investing. They want a higher kind of community and social impact. And so they allow us to take more risk. And so we typically end up financing businesses or nonprofits or early care and learning child care enterprises that either can't get a loan from a bank for a variety of credit or cash flow or collateral reasons, or can't get all that they need. Banks, a lot of times banks will come to us and say, I have a great business. I think they can cash flow. There's just not enough collateral for the bank to feel comfortable lending all that they need for this project. Could VCLF, could you come in subordinate to us and kind of fill out their capital need? So we see that. We partner a lot with banks on projects.
Jake, how does the everyday Vermonter get into the loan fund and invest in the loan fund? What's the process, and is there a minimum? What do they have to do?
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool, and I want to highlight how VCLF is a little bit different maybe than other organizations like us. Like Will said, we're a class of organization certified by the U.S. Department of Treasury called the Community Development Financial Institution, or CDFI. CDFIs can be loan funds. They can be community development credit unions like Opportunities Credit Union up in Burlington. They can be venture funds. They can be community development banks. There's pretty much every version of a financial institution can have a CDFI counterpart. Most CDFIs capitalize, get the money that they are able to work with from other financial institutions. So you see some of the bigger banks in the country and around the world are some of the bigger investors in CDFIs. And then there's this smaller group of CDFIs that capitalize from individuals. And because of the financial regulations in Vermont, which still provide a ton of protection for individuals, Vermonters are able to invest in an organization like the Loan Fund where they're not able to do that. Citizens in other states are not able to do that in their own states. And so where you would see other CDFIs around the country, their capital would be much bigger chunks from banks or the federal government, different programs in the federal government, like the Small Business Administration, USDA Rural Development, the Economic Development Authority, or some of the big players in our space. The Vermont Community Loan Fund is much more diversified and very singular in that individuals, regular folks, and I'll talk a little bit about the scale and the mechanics of it, but the regular folks are able to invest in the loan fund, and they comprise about half of our capital today, which is really unheard of in our industry. Wow. Both CDFIs are capitalized very differently. So we have a much broader base of support, a lot more people in the pool with us. And so that really is the community in the Vermont Community Loan Fund that is very authentic in a way that some other CDFIs, just because of their business model, aren't quite able to achieve. We have investments from all those typical folks as well, from all the big players in the CDFI space, including the state of Vermont, which is should be commended for investing in an organization like us. Not all state governments are on board with CDFIs, but the state of Vermont is on board, the treasurer's office, the federal government. We get money from all of those pots that I mentioned earlier. Banks, corporations, foundations, and other nonprofits all can invest in the loan fund. And where individuals are able to, in some other places, only accredited individuals or higher wealth folks are able to do that, in Vermont, anyone can do it. And like I said, our basic product is works mechanically a lot like a certificate of deposit, and you can start at $1,000. So it's really accessible in the impact investing space and in individual investors being able to direct their money to meet the needs that they see in the community and affect the change that they see in the community. The loan fund is able to do that in a really direct way for regular folks here in Vermont, which is very cool.
Outstanding. Jake Ide and Will Belanger of the Vermont Community Loan Fund are with me. You can ask them a question or share your comments. We can be reached at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And Tim did email us, and he asked, how does a nonprofit get approved for a loan? They must make some profit, right? Will, what is the story there? You know, does a nonprofit have to make a profit to get approved for a loan?
You know, not the nonprofit. Do they need to make a profit? They need to be able to have revenues and income that is sufficient to repay the loan, just like anyone else. And most nonprofits are sustainable and are doing great work and have sources of revenue that help them pay for that work, and whether it's a government paying for it or private donations or other sources or program income, maybe an activity they do actually produces some revenue. A theater company might have ticket sales, things like that. We look at a nonprofit just like we look at any borrower from the fund. We look at their sources of revenues, and will the thing they want to borrow money from generate enough revenue and enough to repay that loan? We look at it very similar to we look at any institute, any business. It's quite interesting. So, for example, the Boys and Girls Club of Burlington is a great organization, nonprofit, that's providing incredible support and services to the youth and children and families in the greater Burlington area. A diverse population with a lot of needs, a lot of folks that are looking for recreation and other support through the Boys and Girls Club and a sense of community. And they get their funds from private donations. They get their funds from the state of Vermont and from the federal government and from some of the work that they do generates income. And so when they came to us to improve, and just like any organization, they have a facility. They want to improve it. They want to build or renovate a building or fix their pool. They borrow money for that, and we evaluate their capability to repay it, as well as the impact that they're providing for the communities and the family.
Tim, thanks so much for that question. Jake, when people express an interest in the loan fund, what do you tell them about investing?
Well, I think that the idea of impact investing, which is kind of the popular term that it has now, has existed for a long time. I think that a lot of us look at our own assets and, it feels like if they're just sitting in an account, ticking away, earning interest, they're not really doing a whole lot. It's idle money, and it may be doing well for me and my family and my future, but it's not really doing anything tangible. It's just making money. What the loan fund can do is that we certainly can do that. We've never not repaid an investor. And so the folks that are coming to us to invest can rely on our ability to repay them and our ability to meet their financial goals. But what we can do on top of that is, really mobilize their money and activate it in a way that a traditional interest-bearing account isn't necessarily going to do. And the kind of value add for the loan fund is that we can do it for folks right here in Vermont. So while there's lots of great things to invest in, renewable energy and all sorts of other things that are making the world better, and kudos to all of it, the loan fund offers folks the opportunity to really put their money to use right here in Vermont. And we think that we know that that's very rare. We think it's very special.
Well, 3.5 decades of doing this, how much has VCLF invested and into how many organizations?
Jake, I'm going to throw that one to Jake. He might have the most current numbers on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Since 1987, the Loan Fund has lent about $113 million. So that's the financial impact. We, of course, think about the impact in different ways. And what that $13 million really means to us when we think about it is that equates to 7,000 jobs in Vermont created or preserved, 4,300 kids that have access to quality early care and learning programs, and 42,000 permanently affordable units of housing for Vermont families of any size, whether that's individuals, seniors, families, the whole gamut of affordable housing. And then if you look at the nonprofits that we've financed over the year, you get into kind of speculative numbers. You know, hundreds of thousands of Vermonters have been touched by the Loan Fund's work over those 30 years. Right now, the current portfolio sits at about 250 loans, and what that looks like to us is about 1,600 kids in quality early care and learning programs, about 1,300 homes, 53,000 Vermonters, receiving essential services from the nonprofits and community organizations that we're financing today. And, presently the portfolio sits at about 2,400, Vermont jobs being worked today.
Those are some incredible numbers that you have certainly racked up through the years of the Vermont Community Loan Fund. And when we're going to take a break, we've got to go to the CBS News update in just a moment here. But when we come back, Will, I am going to ask you about some specific groups that you target and the programs that you set up. We'll start thinking about the Northern Vermont Recovery Loan Fund. That's where we'll start when we get back from our break, which is coming up here. I'm speaking with Will Belanger. He's the executive director of the Vermont Community Loan Fund, and Jake Ide, director of investment and philanthropy. We're talking about the work of the fund, and we'll also then be talking about the different programs that they have set up. You can stay with us, and you can call us 244-1777. Our toll-free number is 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. And you can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. CBS News update coming up in just a moment, and then we'll be back with the folks from VCLF.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Outdoor Gear Exchange, the North Branch Nature Center, Aqua Vitae, Mamava, farms, nonprofit organizations, childcare centers, all vital parts of the Vermont community and economy, and all examples of businesses or organizations that have been helped by the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Jake Ide and Will Belanger from VCLF are with me talking about the work they do and the various programs they've set up to help you and your neighbors. If you'd like to ask them a question, share a comment about VCLF, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Well, I mentioned right before the break some of these programs that you set up. One is called the Northern Vermont Recovery Loan Fund. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, you know, as everyone knows, there's a lot of organizations and businesses in crisis now, right now. And there's been a lot of programs that are been designed by the state and the federal government to try to keep business, and really it comes down to keep businesses alive and open, even if they're not able to serve customers, but make sure that when we do come out at the end of this, which we will, that they're alive, that they are able to pick back up and serve and provide those that economic opportunity that we all and the community impact that we all need from these organizations and businesses. And so one of the things that came through was funds for through the U.S. Economic Development Authority to provide to provide capital for folks like BCLF that we can that can serve and help folks that have really been impacted by coronavirus by the economic impacts. And so the Northern Vermont Recovery Fund serves the six northern counties of Vermont. It's the three northeast counties: Franklin, Grand Isle, and Lamoille. And that was a geography that was told to us by the EDA, by the government.
Gotcha.
But it was really designed, the capital is really designed to alleviate the sudden and severe, you know, economic issues that have been caused by the pandemic. This focused fund will really focus on building economic resilience as a response to coronavirus and to respond to direct economic injuries resulting from it by financing businesses in diverse sectors. So we're looking to finance businesses in the food, farm, and forest, agriculture, manufacturing, tourism, early care and learning, and nonprofits, other drivers in our rural economies in northern Vermont. And we really designed it. We hope to get this money out in a way that is incredibly useful. So we're going to lend it, but we're going to lend it out at 0% for the first 2 years, and then 3% thereafter. So we designed it, one, to help in the immediate, to have no interest cost, and then ongoing a low interest rate on that capital. There's not a lot of it. We were only able to receive about $1 million from the EDA to fund this. We are looking to other sources of capital to try to expand this program throughout Vermont using other sources that aren't just restricted to those six northern counties, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. Mm-hmm. So right now it is just focused on those six counties. But we're hoping to get that money. There's been a lot of demand, a lot of interest in it. We just kind of announced it in December. My director of business lending, Dan Winslow, has told me that his expectation is it'll be probably lent out through the end, maybe by the end of March, by the end of February, middle of March. He's seen a lot of inquiries and demand for this product. So if you've seen impact, if you've seen economic injury, or you are pivoting to something that can improve your business or your nonprofit and in response to the coronavirus and the issues that's created economically and health related, give us a call, send us an email, talk to our loan team.
All right. And Jake, as Will mentioned, you know, it has been a difficult year financially for so many people and organizations. Has it been more difficult in raising money for the fund?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rick. Honestly, I have to say no. We've been incredibly fortunate this year that with a lot of the, the crises that are facing our country today, whether that's COVID or racial injustice, the climate crisis, these are the issues that the folks that want to invest in the loan fund care about. And so we have seen an incredible outpouring of support, both investment capital and philanthropic capital. We're a nonprofit ourselves, and so we rely on philanthropy and gifts to, meet our bottom line. Just when you think about what we've done this year as far as launching new programs and what we're planning to do in 2021, none of it would be possible without the incredible outpouring of support that we've seen from all levels. So, while it's a time of incredible economic uncertainty for so many folks, the loan fund is stronger and, better able to meet our mission and to serve those folks that need us more right now.
The website that Will was alluding to, investinvermont.org, is where you can find VCLF. Will, have you had to suspend or forgive loans during the pandemic?
You know, Rick, this has been a challenging year for businesses and organizations. And, you know, just to give you the kind of the immediate history, in when everything kind of shut down this March, you know, it kind of snowballed on all of us. It was like daily. It just got worse and worse day by day in March. And, you know, the loan fund itself as an organization, on, I think it was March 16th on Monday, we went into the office that Monday and I sent everyone home, and we just started going remote from that day on. We immediately called all of our roughly 250 borrowers and asked them, what do you need? Like, what do you need? We can immediately provide you with payment relief, defer principal, defer all payments. What do you need? About 28% of our borrowers took us up on that immediately.
Yeah.
Said, yes, we need that. So 28% of our borrowers, we went into a modified payment, modified payments on for their loans. Today, less than 3% are still on that. Wow. Everyone else has come back onto regular payments. And the 3%, if you think about it, it's mostly around really hospitality businesses, a couple bed and breakfasts and restaurants that are still under a modified payment structure. That's not to say those that are paying us aren't still under stress, right? So even the affordable housing projects that we have financed, you know, that their repayment really relies on rental income, and these are low-income people, and there are some struggles. There are definite struggles, but the portfolio right now is doing very well. I attribute that to a couple of things. There's been a lot of federal and state resources that have flowed into the state of Vermont. Don't quote me on this, but it's in the $4.5 to $5 billion through unemployment, enhanced unemployment, and the PPP, and direct monies to the state. The state did an incredible job getting out to small businesses and organizations. A lot of money, and that's helped. But as we all know, and this may be the only time I want to get into anything that touches on political, as we all know, those monies are running out. We've expended them, and we do need additional support in the state to get us through to that promised land of a vaccine, right? That promised land where we can get out on the other side of this. And that's going to be important to keep our businesses and our organizations vital and alive and operating, you know, this summer. And that's just going to be critical to the Vermont economy. It's going to cost us, Vermont, if all those businesses and organizations shut down and cannot reopen, the cost to our rural communities will be immense.
Yeah.
And so we do need that help to get to where we can reopen without restriction.
And we only have a few more minutes. I have about a million more questions for the two of you, so I'm going to do my best to hit a few here. Will, is there any program that you have that targets racial inequity?
You know, great question. We've, as many organizations and people in Vermont, you know, the racial injustice issues that have come to light over the summer have really struck home and dearly, and like many institutions, the loan fund wanted to and wants to expand its work to address racial justice. At our core, the loan fund is a justice organization. We've always sought to to work on issues of social and economic justice, on environmental justice, and it is natural to us to think about how we can work more deeply in issues of racial justice. And so we have, as an organization, been working internally, but I would say that our big push in moving into 2021 is to stand up a racial equity loan fund, a fund that can better serve or more deeply serve the incredible diverse communities and the wonderful communities that we have in Vermont, that, you know, from people from all nationalities and all racially makeups, just we have some incredibly vibrant communities in Vermont that still struggle to access capital and to integrate better in our kind of capitalist system. And so we want to see how we can, as an organization, work deeper in those communities. So right now we are organizing partners. We are organizing resources to better address work within these communities, to better address the needs of the families and the communities within here in Vermont, so that we can provide loan capital that can meet those needs. And we're really looking at do we need to change kind of the loan underwriting, which is a real technical, you know, just how we analyze a business or how we analyze a nonprofit that's serving these communities. Do we need to look at translation services and do we need to get partners that can help us with that, with folks where English is not their first language, where they better understand these kind of technical loan terms in a language that's not English, and how do we manage that? So we're really excited about standing up a fund that can really address these issues and that can maybe get to some of the core injustice, at least in the way that we know how as a capital provider, to be able to improve the lives of folks that have really struggled in accessing capital and really struggled in accessing the economic benefits of living in Vermont, living in the United States.
Jake, when people invest with VCLF, can they identify that they want their money to be used specifically for a type of business, like a child care facility or a specific fund that you have?
No, the economic security of investing in the loan fund is really necessitated on the fact that typically the money goes into a single pool. We don't track an investor's dollar to a specific loan, you know, and then having the consequence of if that loan for some reason doesn't succeed, that investor doesn't get repaid. The safety in the loan fund is that all the money is put into one pot and distributed from there. Now, within that, there is some opportunity for investors to earmark their funds towards a specific program or sector that they're most excited by and want to affect the kind of change that they want to see with. And so we have folks that can invest in our Food, Farms, and Forests Fund, which is pretty self-explanatory. We have folks that want to earmark their money for early care and learning and various other kinds of programs like that. So the investor does have some control over the where the money goes, but doesn't really share the risk. The risk is the loan fund.
Gotcha. Will, there's something you have called the Sprout Program. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Sprout Program was a great partnership that we did with the Working Lands Enterprise Initiative, which is a state entity that's really looking at wanting to support working lands businesses. And we talked with them about subsidizing loan capital, and they were excited about it. And so for about the last 3 years, we had our Sprout Loan Program, which provided low interest rate loans. I think the first round, it was 0% for 2 years and then 2% thereafter. I think the second round, we changed it a little bit. It became 1%. I think it was 1% interest only loans. That's what we're currently at now, 1% interest only loans for 2 years and then 2% thereafter. And we're able to do that with support from from the Working Lands Enterprise Board, which provided grants. The first two rounds, with the support from them, we made about $900,000 worth of loans under this Sprout program, and we actually have a third round that's just starting up with the same kind of interest rates, but it's really great. It's really to support food farms and forests. It's really to support those working lands businesses, and it's really ultimately looking at rural economic development, right? It's really supporting businesses in our rural communities, which are mostly natural resource-based, mostly agriculture or forest-based businesses. And we're really excited about kind of having a third round of this. We figure we'll have about $300,000 to $400,000 of available capital within this program over the next year. You know, they're smaller loans. You know, we're probably doing it. Average loan size is probably around $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
We've done small loans as low as $5,000 in this program. So it's doing some smaller loans. Really looking at those businesses that a lot of startup businesses, a lot of startup agriculture, a lot of startup food businesses have taken advantage of this in the past.
And Jake, very quickly, have you had people who started out receiving a loan and eventually invest it into the fund?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great record of success for us. Our favorite is when a borrower, obviously is a borrower for us and then is able to move on and access conventional bank financing. The frosting on the cake for us is when folks like Hunger Mountain Co-op, another great example of this, is able to then get secure, generate their own assets, and are able to give back to the community that was able to give them through the loan fund. And so, yeah, we have that happen quite a bit.
Great story. Jake Ide and Will Belanger from Vermont Community Loan Fund, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And thanks, Rick.
You can find the fund at investinvermont.org. CBS News is next. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Last hour, we talked about the financial help that's available to community members looking to start a business or for farms or nonprofits or child care facilities. Now we'll focus on another organization providing help in a different way. Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice provides medically necessary health and supportive care services to Central Vermonters in the comfort and privacy of home. Emily McKenna is the Director of Marketing and Communications. Emily, nice to have you on Vermont Viewpoint today.
Hi, thank you.
And Diana Moore is the Bereavement Coordinator at CVHHH. And thank you for being with us today, Diana.
Thanks for having me.
If you've got a question, listeners, or a comment about CVHHH, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. If you or a loved one enlisted their services, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So, Emily, give us an overview of what CVHHH does.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. So we are, as you said, we're a not-for-profit visiting nurse association. And I should add that there are 9 visiting nurse associations in the state of Vermont. So every Vermonter has access to care through one of our organizations, through the network of VNAs in Vermont. And I think to put it simply, what we do is we bring care to people at home, and we bring care kind of to anyone who needs it, regardless of their ability to pay for the services, and for people at all stages of life. So we care for pregnant women while they're pregnant and after they give birth. We kind of, throughout a person's whole life, there are many ways in which we could help them bringing skilled nursing care to them at home, wound care, PT after a joint replacement. And then as people get towards the end of their life, Diana's part of our hospice and palliative care team, we go into people's homes and we give them interdisciplinary wraparound care to help them through the end-of-life process.
And who are the people you serve?
We serve 23 communities in Washington County and Orange County. The majority, we serve all of Washington County and three communities in Orange. And again, it's kind of anyone who needs our care, we will most likely figure out a way to give them the care that they need. And again, it's anyone from newborn babies to people at the very end of life. I was just speaking with someone yesterday. He lives in Montpelier, and his father was living at Westview Meadows, and his dad turned 100 last year, and he's now living with him at home, and we provide personal care services and companionship. So it's really, there's a full spectrum of people that we could potentially care for and do care for.
Diana, it's something we might not want to think about, but it's an important service. This is the bereavement. How do you work with people in this area?
Well, mostly by phone right now. I have offered visits in the past to family members who have lost loved ones on hospice care. That's my primary focus, is to provide grief support for all of the family members that need it in some way or other, whether it's through talking one-on-one or through our support groups that we provide now with Zoom, thankfully, to technology, or referring them to other folks if need be, too.
What kind of coping techniques do you teach or provide to people who have experienced the loss of a loved one?
Oh, that is something we talk a lot about, especially in the grief support groups. Talking about it is one of the primary coping techniques. Sometimes people want to shove it under the rug, you know,
right,
and not address it. Or we get encouraged by our culture, too, to move on, get over it. So we talk a lot about talking about it. Tell the stories about your loved ones. Share how you're feeling, because that's really the only way to move through it. And we talk about that, too, not getting over, but moving through. And we also do a lot with breath, just taking some deep breaths when we can. That's the easiest thing to do.
Breathing, wow,
just
a simple
breathing
technique. But
yeah,
but how does talking about it, because it can be so painful, it can it's just physically racking sometimes to bring it back up again and talk about it. How does that help someone who's trying to get through the grieving process?
It's such a good question. To allow ourselves to move into the pain is very important. And we live in a culture, again, that doesn't really encourage us to do that. There are lots of pain remedies, you know, and we're not encouraged to move through pain. But really, that's the only way to get through it, is to go into it. And to do that with help, you know, if that's helpful. Some people can do it on their own. Some people need help. Someone, whether it's a good friend or a family member or a minister or a counselor, a group. And that's the only way, because it's going to come up for us anyway. If we try to push it aside, our feelings, grief has a way of doing that. It comes up when we least expect it, if we keep pushing it aside. So to purposely address it and meet it head on is healthier.
Emily, I want to focus a bit on the home part of home health and hospice. You know, why is that such an important H in the CVHHH idea?
I think Diana can certainly talk about that question from the point of view of someone and their family dealing with the end of life. But mm-hmm. I mean, I think really generally, you know, what do you have at home? You have your belongings, and you have your family, and you have the ability to kind of, as much as you can, continue with your daily routine and to do the things that bring meaning into your life. And I think under almost all circumstances, there's a lot of value to being able to heal at home if you can. I think there are probably studies that say people who can heal at home have experienced a better quality of life, and they probably heal more quickly than they do in certain circumstances than if they were to go to a facility. I just think there's a real emotional component to being in your own space and being able to stay connected with the people and the things that you value that we really can't even quantify. It's just so important.
Mm-hmm. And Diana, in that end of life period, why is and how is being at home so important?
Well, I think back to my stepfather who died on hospice care back in 2007, and his choice was to be in his recliner where he could look out the living room window and see the deer come down, you know, every day. And it's like that. It's like Emily said, being in a place where you're comfortable, where you're surrounded by family and loved ones, where you have your familiar, your place is familiar to you. It's less sterile.
Diana, let's look at the reality of what people have been dealing with during this pandemic, this isolation, and combine that with a loss of a loved one. How difficult has that been for the people that you work with?
Oh, it's added such a huge difficult dimension to everything. A lot of our traditions that we might normally do, like funerals or even just going to somebody's home with a plate of food or something like that, those things have changed, halted for some, just shifted for others, where we can't get together, people can't freely offer hugs of support. I mean, it's changed everything. So a lot of folks who are grieving are feeling very isolated and very alone. For those who are fortunate enough to live with family members, they have that. But a lot of people live alone. And when their partners, for instance, die, they're more alone. And it's extremely isolating, very, very difficult.
I don't want to make light of it, but when this pandemic is over, we are going to hug.
Yeah, I've had that vision too.
You said the word, and like I think everybody who's listening right now thought, oh, please, just one hug.
Yeah, yeah.
But I am going to add one more stressful element to this, Diana, because right now it's the holidays. So
right.
How does that affect what people are going through?
Yeah, I've sort of called it the perfect storm. When we're isolated and we're alone and we're feeling deep grief, and then we enter the holidays where there's this, again, a cultural expectation and maybe a family expectation to be cheerful and joyful and, you know, bring in the light and bring in the presents, and oh my goodness, it's a lot. And so a lot of people just can't do it this year. They don't want to do it. They don't want to decorate. They don't want to cook. They don't want to, and it's okay not to. It's okay not to to do Christmas or the holiday of your spiritual tradition. It's okay to opt out, and a lot of people are choosing to do that.
And we've got a call from Nancy in Morrisville. Nancy, thanks for joining the discussion today. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I am so happy to be participating in this particular discussion. Earlier this year, I lost my husband rather suddenly. I am completely alone. I don't have kids. And he passed away shortly before the COVID situation. But I'll tell you what, when I heard that she was offering the bereavement support for spouses, I called to inquire, and I acknowledged that I actually have wonderful support from several groups and, you know, church friends, et cetera. But I was interested that I wanted to give it a try to participate in this group, but I wasn't sure that I was going to stay. And I wanted to be upfront about it in case it didn't suit me. I cannot tell you how much I gained from participation. It was so valuable. Diana is an excellent facilitator. Over the time, and I think there were maybe seven of us in her group, I really gained insights and empathy, and I was just so glad to have participated, and I would most certainly recommend that anybody in a loss look into participating. And just thank you to the whole organization, but especially to Diana, because she just eased the situation so much. Thank you so much.
Nancy, that is a great call and high praise. And Diana, talk more about how you work with individuals in this situation, especially now with the pandemic and having to use Zoom, for instance.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Nancy, for speaking out about that. Zoom is a real gift. It's like being in the same room, but not, you know, and people can be in their own homes, and it's kind of another comfort level in joining a group experience. So somebody, if they're interested in the grief support group, just needs to email me or call, but I send the email link out to those who are interested. We've got a group that's going on now that's pretty full, another group that starts in January for spouses. But yeah, Zoom has been a big gift. And other than that, I make phone calls to families. That's my service. My end of the hospice program is to call loved ones after their loved one has died, and offer to be here with one-on-one calls if that's helpful, or the support group. I send information if that seems helpful. We have comfort bags for children that are pretty sweet, that are donated by the Northfield Women's Methodist Church, Northfield Methodist Church Women's Group, sorry. A few other things that we can provide for support for families.
Using Zoom, has it been a great learning curve for you compared to how you've been able to provide your services in the past?
It's definitely been a shift, yeah. I haven't been historically the most technically savvy person, but I've learned a lot. And
right.
Facilitating with Zoom is just different. And it seems to work. I tend to keep time for folks and call on folks to talk, so that we have, it seems like that, yeah, we have to have a little bit more structure, I think. But that seems to be all right, too. A lot of people, I think, feel safe with that structure.
Emily, how has the staff there at CVHHH stepped up during this pandemic?
That is a good question. I really can't say enough about how everyone... at the organization, I think, understood the importance of continuing to carry out our mission and to care for Central Vermonters during this crisis and this pandemic. And, you know, I like to say that home health nurses, just because of how they do their jobs, they are so good at adapting and pivoting and getting creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of exactly what they did. As soon as the pandemic hit, we just put in place a number of protocols and screening processes, and acquired PPE and started communicating and providing education to staff so that they felt supported and were protected. And they really stepped up. And it's, this has been such a challenging period in our lives, but it's been really amazing to see how really like nothing has changed in terms of their commitment to going out into the community and providing care. And, you know, Diana's, how she's adapted to provide the groups is just one example, you know, of many of how that's happened. So wonderfully, I would say.
Let's take another call. We have Paula calling us from Brookfield. Good morning, Paula. Go right ahead.
Hi there. For a long time, I've supported Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice with financial donations, just because I believe very ardently in the mission of both of those services. And it wasn't until just before the pandemic hit that I ended up as a receiver of those incredible services. My husband became suddenly ill, died after about 4 days of illness. He was in the care of their hospice services. And then some months after that, I joined a support group, like Nancy, your previous caller. And that support group was just incredibly helpful to me. Some of us have maintained contact with each other, continued to support each other, and a lot of that was due to the expert facilitation of Diana, who created a very safe and very caring space for us to all care for each other.
Well, Paula, I'm very sorry about the loss of your husband, but did this happen during the pandemic? And so were the support groups conducted over Zoom?
No. The support group was actually over Zoom. My husband died February 1st, but the support group was over the summer. And I had to participate over the phone because my computer was too old to take Zoom.
We
so
get it.
I'm in solidarity with Diana and all the technological challenges, but she did an expert job of bringing those two of us in that had to use the phone, that didn't have the technology to be able to use Zoom, and made us feel just as valued and able to participate as the people that could see each other. It was just terrific.
Wow, what a beautiful experience. Paula, thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Diana, I would love to just open up the phones and have all your satisfied clients. This is really wonderful to hear. How about some tips for people who are grieving? What are the things that you know, practical tips that you recommend to people when they're grieving?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. One is just to acknowledge that this is going to be a different time of the year. It's going to be a different season. It's going to be a different day. And just to acknowledge that and to try to accept it, even though that can be hard. But some specific things people can do. Lighting a candle is something a lot of people do as part of a ritual or ceremony, but it's something you can just do on a daily basis to remember your loved one. Some people, for the holidays specifically, set a table setting where that person might have sat. That can be a hard one for some, but for others it seems to fill a little bit of the void. And then memories can be shared about that person, you know, like they're sitting there too. You can make a donation to somewhere in their honor. Sometimes giving to others is helpful for us to feel a little bit better in our own hearts. Have someone to connect with, even if it's a brief Zoom call or a FaceTime call or a phone call or maybe a car-to-car visit, but to make an arrangement, if you can, to have someone to talk to that day or during this time. Some people write letters to their loved ones who have died, and it's like a journaling experience, but maybe different, specifically to communicate with them in that way and in your heart, from your heart. There are lots of other things.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned that you have another support group coming up, I think starting sometime in January. So can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yes, January 27 is the beginning of our next group for spouses and partners who have lost loved ones. And all our groups meet for six-week sessions at this point. So I'm calling up my...
You're not so technologically challenged as you said you were, Diana.
I had my schedule in front of me on the computer, and then the computer page went off. But anyway,
of course.
Yes, and then in February, we begin another round of general grief support for anybody who's grieving. I have a journaling group that meets when I have enough folks sign up. That's a guided journal using a beautiful book from Alan Wolfelt with prompts in the journal. Beautiful, deep process. And when I get five or six people to sign up, then I do that group, and I currently have two. So if there are three folks who would like to do that, let me know.
You can find information at cvhhh.org. Emily, the organization, is there a need for, I think we heard one of our callers mentioned making donations. Is there a need for that and for volunteers at CVHHH?
Yes, absolutely. We are getting toward the end of our fall appeal. We have some incredible honorary chairs, actually, kind of as the faces of this campaign, Ed and Trish Reed, who own a garden center in Waitsfield. All the information is on our website, So if someone wants to donate, we can definitely take that at cbhhh.org. And volunteers, we have volunteer opportunities with hospice in our office when we can, at events. So there are many opportunities to support our agency, and all of the information is on our website. So please go there.
That's Emily McKenna. She's Director of Marketing and Communications at Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. And we've also spoken with Diana Moore, the Bereavement Coordinator at CVHHH. I want to thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
And you can learn more about their work, again, at cvhhh.org. The CBS News update next, and then we'll be back to meet the real live nerdy girl in chief here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Medical talk. Science. We're getting a ton of it from Dr. Fauci, Dr. Levine, and many others. And they're doing their jobs well, but sometimes it's all, you know, science-y. And you just want to hear it from someone who can explain it in your terms, who can digest it a little and make you understand why you're being asked to do the stuff you're being asked to do in this pandemic. My next guest is one of those people. Her name is Lindsay Leininger, and she proudly brags that she's the nerdy girl in chief at Dear Pandemic. She is, but she's also a clinical professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. And although she'll modestly deflect praise like this, she's rather brilliant. Lindsay Leininger, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Listeners, if you've got COVID questions, vaccine concerns, pandemic problems, bring them on. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255, and our email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So you're this nerdy girl in chief at Dear Pandemic. What is Dear Pandemic?
Well,
and that's not D-E-E-R, it's D-E-A-R, as in Dear Pandemic.
That's right, or Dear Abby, the advice column, from which we got our inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
So Dear Pandemic is a public education campaign that provides trustworthy and timely information about all things life during a pandemic.
And how was it formed? Who are in it?
So we are an all-female team of scientists and clinicians, and an early follower dubbed us the Nerdy Girls, and the name has just kind of stuck. So we are a dozen women scientists and clinicians who take questions and answer them with as much honesty and kindness as we can. We're about 55,000 followers strong on Facebook,
ooh,
and we also have a website and Instagram and Twitter profiles.
What do you hope that you're providing?
You know, Rick, in my heart of hearts, I am just hoping that we are helping people feel a little more educated and empowered to make good decisions for themselves and their families right now during this really rotten time.
Yeah, it is kind of a rotten time. And again, I'm glad you boil it down that quickly. Why was this something that you just had to be involved in?
So I teach people how to make sense of medical data. That is actually my day job here at Dartmouth. And in the past, that's primarily involved policymakers and executives and future executives, my MBA students. So I was like, you know what? I think I might have some good tools to help. I am paid to teach people how to think about medical data. And I think with some small adaptations, that might work on Facebook. I mean, crazy idea, right? But but I think we might be onto something.
Yeah, you use Facebook. Explain how you get the word out. You got all these followers. You're taking kind of the message to the people in the right way now.
That's right. And we started with friends and family. I mean, a lot of us are friends and colleagues on the team, predating the pandemic. And we joined together to answer our family's questions on Facebook, right? Like, we were all getting really similar questions. People might remember back in March, like, oh, do I need to wipe down my groceries, for example?
No, right.
So our team decided to take these questions from our friends and family on as a collective. And then it just kind of grew by word of mouth from there. And now we have this beautiful community on Facebook. I think as a collective, we've done almost 300 traditional media appearances like this one. And we're just really committed to helping people stay safe and stay sane during the pandemic. That's our motto.
I was really proud to see that two of my Facebook friends had already been following you when I jumped on. So,
Yay, I know.
It's like now there's a little community of us, one here in Vermont, one's down in Boston now. And, you mentioned the question about, wiping off your groceries when you get them home. What are a couple other kinds of questions that you get asked?
Well, it really depends on what's most timely. So, we surf the news cycle just like everybody else, right? Like, we get confused and befuddled and are trying to make sense of all the emerging science. And right now there are two topics that our community really has top of mind. And the first is schools. Our community is national in scope, and many have had children out of school since last March, out of in-person school. So that's a consistent hot topic. And then the other big one, of course, is vaccines. And Rick, I'm really excited because three of the nerdy girls are actually experts in building vaccine competence.
Wow.
So we're doing, yeah, I know, right? We're just doing a lot of messaging around the safety and the trust that people can have in the vaccines.
This is fabulous. You got a Dear Pandemic and you've got your own testing team, your own team that can kind of parse out what's going on with vaccines. I love that. When you started, was there a lot of skepticism you were getting about COVID and its existence?
Rick, there is. And I'm a native Texan, and there's still a lot of skepticism back home. So it's still something that we contend with. To be totally candid, we get some pretty nasty trolls. We hide them. We move on. But yes, there's a lot of denialism that is a part of our work. And, we try to keep an open mind to anyone who has an open heart, but just straight up nastiness just won't do.
I get that. So how do you do the research, when questions come up or, you're following something and you say, oh, hey, nerdy girls, we need to do some investigating into this. What kind of investigation do you do so you got the right 411?
What a great question. I love talking about our nerdy process. So we as a team range from immunology to family medicine to health policy and economics and epidemiology and everything in between. So often we have our own internal expert who knows exactly what we need to be reading. But one of the other beautiful things is that when we have an issue that we don't know about, we have made a huge network of friends and colleagues and partners across all of the health sciences with this work. So we have a really extensive network with other scientists. And then we are very quick reads when it comes to medical and science data, because that's what we do for our day jobs.
Do the nerdy girls ever disagree and debate topics?
Oh, Rick, you got 12 MD and PhD trained women on a team. We definitely have spirited debate within our team. And I think that that's healthy because it demonstrates we have a diversity of opinions and backgrounds on our team. And also, I think it's really important to share this with others because there's also a humility and a modesty about what the data can say in such a new and uncertain situation.
Lindsay, not everyone trusts the science of things today. Why do you think that is?
I think we have had a really tough backdrop against which science has been tested. And I think there are a couple of things that have made it difficult. And I do think that leadership at the top doubting science can make things more difficult. So a politician of any affiliation, it doesn't matter if they're a Democrat or a Republican, who is out in public denigrating science, does make my job harder. So there's that. I think the other thing, and something that I really try to stress, is that science is a method, not a fixed set of facts. So we need to be aware of scientists who don't change their minds, which I think is confusing, right? Because we're like, wait a minute, the scientists said we do need to be wiping down our groceries, and now they say we don't. Well, that's because we've learned that COVID doesn't spread very easily on surfaces. So I think the fact that we're learning so much so quickly about a new disease, which means that there's going to be some shifts in scientific guidance, can understandably be confusing and can erode trust.
Wow. I might have to get this as a tattoo. Science is a method, not a fixed set of facts. If I've learned nothing else today, that's really gold. That's really something important to know about and to kind of hold on to, because we do find, you know, that sometimes this was what science believed at one point, but we've like tested it and used the method, and now we've learned so much more. Okay, Lindsay, I want to learn some stuff. First of all, I know you nerdy girls love the SMART principles. What are they?
We love our Stay Smart principles. Yes. So S is for space, 6 feet or more. M is for mask, keep it on. A is for air, keep it fresh, outside as best as possible. R is for restrict, keep your social bubble as small and stable as possible. And T is for time, keep interactions with those outside your household as short as possible. So stay smart while we all hold on tight to our hope that's in the form of a vaccine.
And we'll talk a little bit about the vaccine in just a moment. But it's holiday time, so, you know, how should we be behaving? We all want to get together. We all want the traditional get-togethers that we know and love. But how should we approach the holidays that are just ahead?
Yeah, Rick, we are getting this question a lot. And boy, it's tough, right? Because the things that we hold most sacred are the things that facilitate this virus spreading. And I think that's what's really awful about this virus. So what we've been counseling people to do is to hold on to the emotion and what's sacred about the holidays and try to do it in a safer way. So I'd mentioned earlier, I'm a native Texan. Typically, I travel back home to Christmas. I can't do that this year for safety, so I'll be Zooming with my parents. I'll be Zooming with my aunts. I will be trying to bake my own cheese enchiladas. They won't be as good as those back home, but I'm trying to hold on to that tradition because it just means so much to me.
Yeah, I had family, cousins, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews on Thanksgiving. Zoom for, I think I kept it open for about 5 or 6 hours, and it was an absolute incredible thing to just have people kind of come in and out, and you know, at any given time, you'd have three or four to about 8 or 9 people. We had one from Australia join us, and it was as wonderful as any Thanksgiving I've ever been involved with. So you can still do all those things, still feel the love of family and friends. You just have to be a little bit more creative, and we'll do it again for a few hours on Christmas Day. I know on Facebook you had someone write, Lindsay, that their religion requires them to attend services, and that's what they'll be doing. So how do you respond to something like that?
That's a great question, and it's a sensitive one, right? Mm-hmm. So again, like, we honor what's sacred, and for many, many people, that is the most sacred thing in their lives. Now, you know, I grew up Catholic, and I know in my home diocese, there's a dispensation, so you can attend services online, which is great. So again, I think there are a lot of alternative ways to celebrate, and especially right now during this season of like the holiest holidays for many faith traditions.
Right.
there's a lot of online options. I do think going outside is an option that is good and worthy, even in the cold in Vermont, New Hampshire. Mm. We're pretty hardy.
we are.
So celebrating religious ceremonies outside, to the extent that, you know, the congregation is open to that. And, you know, again, these smart principles can really help. Like, and some of us don't have choices, whether it be school or work, right? We have to go indoors. And again, there are ways to stay smart in whatever situation your life requires.
Yeah. Well, the vaccines have started to roll out. Are you surprised that it happened as rapidly as it has, that we're getting them out to people already?
Honestly, Rick, I think I speak for a lot of scientists when I say I think it's nothing short of a miracle what's happened. Mm.
Wow. So does that cause any doubt in your mind or people's minds of the effectiveness that it happened as quickly as it did?
So that is a great question. So, you know, one thing that I want to be sure to let people know is that miracles in science mean something different in terms of timelines than in other settings. So this vaccine that we're seeing right now, the mRNA platform, is actually been under study for over 20 years. So when we scientists talk about miracles, that's what we're referring to, right? That a technology that's been under study for 20 years can be turned on for a new disease quickly. So when we talk about speed in science, our timelines are still pretty slow. Huh. So that gives me a lot of reassurance, and I hope it gives others in the public too.
What do you say to people who have always been skeptical of vaccines?
Look, we honor people's emotions, whether it be fear, whether or not they just want what's best for their families. We also honor that there is a ton of really bad information out there, especially about vaccines. So we meet people where they are and really honor the emotion from where this is coming. I think the good news is that the scientific community, medical community, we as a collective have great trust in this vaccine. The technology has been under study for 20 years. The data on the clinical trials have been held to the highest standards of any study data I know of. There has been so much vetting, so much rigor, so many eyes on this. There's just been no room for any sort of shenanigans. So I hope that people know that the scientific and medical communities have great faith in this vaccine. And you know what? We will be writing on vaccines often on Dear Pandemic.
No good.
It's helping boost confidence. Yeah.
And to really be effective, what percentage of the population needs to get this vaccine?
That's great. So we don't have a precise target, but we hear anywhere between 60 and 75%. So that's what we're aiming for. We certainly hope that that happens sooner rather than later, but it's going to take a little while because this is the most massive vaccine rollout campaign we've had, certainly in recent memory and perhaps ever. So we have to sit tight, but we are really hoping to hit that 60 to 75% mark in order to achieve what we call herd immunity. Which actually did, funny story, originate in cattle. So the term herd immunity, which is where the community in general is protected because enough individuals will not be susceptible to the disease, had its origins in veterinary science.
How about that? Lindsay Leininger is a clinical professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, but she might be even more proud that she's nerdy girl in chief at Dear Pandemic. And I told you all she was brilliant. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Lindsay.
Oh, Rick, thanks for having me.
Sure thing. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or gifts. Bill Sayre's up next with Common Sense Radio. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow, and drive safely.